You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On Thursday, March 7th, 2013, Dale Floyd presented the first lecture in a new six-part CPN series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. Henry Halleck defined field works as the art of disposing the ground in such a manner as to enable a small number of troops to resist a larger army the longest time possible. According to Floyd, creating such fortifications was often difficult work. To the scarcity of entrenching tools, many of the men were obliged to use their saber bayonets, tin plates, and in some cases merely their hands, to scrape up the dirt for the breastworks, says Floyd in this podcast. Dale Floyd studied at Ohio University and the University of Dayton. He has written 9 books on military history. Mr. Floyd has been an archivist at the National Archives and an historian with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the National Park Service. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton, in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Moving Dirt, The Evolution of Fieldworks. Here's Dale Floyd.
Basically, what I'm going to do is tell you about the fortifications, what types and how they were used, the influence of them in international warfare, what happened to them after the war, and basically what the status of these fortifications is actually today. Now, I think most of us know that if we don't have some kind of cover in warfare, this is what's going to happen. Now, in 1846, Henry Halleck, who I think most of you have probably heard of before, defined fortifications as the art of disposing the ground in such a manner as to enable a small number of troops to resist a large army the longest time possible. So that's basically the whole idea of having fortifications. Now, when the war started in the United States, basically we did have a number of fortifications. We had on the frontier everything from blockhouses and stockades or palisades to like Fort Snelling, which was in Minnesota, which was a masonry fortification, quite large and quite impressive. We also had coastal fortifications. This is Fort Macon in North Carolina. But there is another type that during the war we built an awful lot of, and that is field fortifications. Now, at West Point, there was a professor by the name of Dennis Hart Mahan. He published a manual called A Treatise on Field Fortification, which first appeared in 1836 and then appeared in many different editions later on. He said, the name of field fortification is applied to a work which is composed of an embankment of earth called a parapet and an excavation called a ditch on the exterior side, which last furnishes the earth for the embankment. He went on to say at one place, when the position is to be occupied only for a short period or during the operation of a campaign, perishable materials as earth and wood are mostly used and the works are denominated temporary or field fortifications. Egbert L. Veal, who was an Army officer, also published a manual called The Handbook for Active Service. He said, field works are any construction which have for their object to impede the advance of the enemy or to enable an inferior force to maintain their position against the attack of a superior number. So basically that's why you have fortifications, and these are the types that... Now, in the U.S., United States, we had been using field fortifications for a long time. This is Bunker Hill, of course, during the Revolution and during the War of 1812, the Seminole Indian Wars, the Mexican War, and some of the other Indian wars out west. We use field fortifications. Also, even the Indians at times erected field fortifications themselves. Now, up until about the 19th century, you had two types of field fortifications. You had siege works, which were used when you were attacking a city or a fortress or something like that. And that goes back to medieval times when they were doing those, and they would try to move them closer and closer to the walls of the fortress or the city and eventually be able to take it. The other type of field fortification they used a lot was to protect towns, depots, bridges, mountain passes, whatever. And those were the basic uses. But in the 19th century, you started seeing them used on the battlefield a lot more. And probably the first real instance that you see a lot of use of them is during the Crimean War, which was 1855-56, basically, 1854-56. Now, we sent a commission over there composed of three U.S. Army officers. Is that upside down? No. Three U.S. Army officers. One was Richard Delafield, who was the engineer that went along. George B. McClellan, who, of course, had been an engineer but was now cavalry. And Alfred Mordecai, who was a Virginian, who was an ordnance expert. And they came back and they published these lengthy reports on what they saw. So if you ever get a chance to see the one, especially by Delafield, but also by McClellan, there's a lot of drawings and whatever of the fortifications that were used in the Crimean War. Others look to one other type of fortification, but Wellington in Spain built what were known as the lines of Torres Vedras to try and stop, and did stop, Napoleon's army in Spain during the Napoleonic War. So those were some of the ones that they looked at. But the Civil War would actually use them in a lot more times and a lot more uses. This is Dennis Hart Mahan, who I mentioned before. He is from Virginia, and all the West Point graduates had him. He taught military engineering, so they would have learned how to build fortifications from Dennis Hart Mahan. Plus, he published this treatise that I mentioned. There were other manuals around that people could have picked up, but an awful lot of them turned to his treatise on field fortification. Now, in his manual, he makes the comment that the means used to strengthen a position may be either those presented by nature, as precipices, woods, rivers, etc., or those formed by art, as shelters of earth, stone, wood, and whatever else you might actually have to use. So we see the various time during the Civil War where they just were hiding behind rocks or whatever it might be, or piling them up. But and of course, this is like the ones that you might have seen on a little round top at Gettysburg. But also, there were various things that were man-made that you could look for to use before you started building fortifications that might protect you also. Here's some men that are fighting from behind some wood. Of course, a wood fence didn't look like it was too effective. Or maybe the sunken road, like at Antietam, or the sunken road at Fredericksburg with a stone wall, or the railroad cut at Second Manassas, or the railroad cut at Gettysburg. But if this wasn't available, then you would probably have to build your own. A lot of people think that they didn't really start using field fortifications till 1864-65, when they were very close to the enemy day after day after day. But actually, right from the beginning, field fortifications were used. And give an example, the army that marched out to First Manassas had engineers in front to clear obstacles and barriers that the Confederates had actually put there. And in 1862, after Shiloh, Halleck took command and erected earthworks nearly every foot of the way from Pittsburgh Landing to Corinth, Mississippi, a distance of at least 20 miles, and then prepared for a regular siege of the latter place, where his army outnumbered that of Beauregard by about 2-1. His approach took a month, at the end of which time Beauregard evacuated and Corinth gave up without any fighting. Now, what I'd like to talk about is how fortifications were actually constructed. And as I said, I will be using a variety of quotes. I think in a lot of instances, the soldiers tell it a lot better than I could. In a manual published in 1861 called A Treatise on the Camp and March, said that to throw up a work, a line is first traced on the ground with a pick, showing the direction of the interior crest, poles having been planted at the angle of the work with the height of the interior crest marked on them. Cords are then stretched at distances of about 30 yards apart, horizontally between two pickets, perpendicular to the lines. Now, that one's not exactly real understandable, but some of these others will be. One soldier said, a line was laid out by our engineers, and we were ordered to fortify our position. Axes and shovels were furnished, and we were soon hard at work. To most of us, this was an unfamiliar effort, but before our service ended, it was one in which we were to become proficient. There was a lot of fallen timber that we gathered and placed lengthwise, then dug a trench behind with the dirt thrown over the logs. The trench was over 2 feet deep, wide enough for the line to stand in, and with the embankment, the total depth was 5 feet. These works were quite strong and would protect the men against attack, for an ordinary projectile could not go through the embankment. An officer wrote, the engineers have just traced out an irregular work to be enclosed in the corner of the wood close to the plank road. It is within 100 yards of the rebel pickets at the Gregory Chimneys, and having rather an ugly lookout for them is not likely to be put up with so little disturbance as the others have. Large parties, too, are at work on a series of covered ways connecting the approaches to the different works. In widening the sunken way immediately behind the parapets along the whole line, draining it, and building proper banquets. I'll explain what a banquet is later. I am getting impatient for this sort of preliminary work to be finished and the approaches to begin. So, basically, it was good to have the engineers lay it out because they knew what they were doing. And one officer wrote, from the lack of educated engineers, the approaches and parallels were in some places badly located and much unnecessary work was done. But others were very happy to have the engineers working. As one soldier wrote, our engineers were already at work surveying a line of fortifications, and until they were finished, we were at rest. This gave us time to get breakfast. An engineer officer himself wrote, the manner of construction of these works of hasty entrenchments usually was this. The men deployed in a line of skirmishers would dig individually shallow trenches about 4 or 5 feet by 2 with their longest dimensions toward the foe and throw up earth in a little mound of a foot or 15 inches in height on the side toward the opponent. This would result in a line of such excavations and mounds, each individually constructed and without any communication with its neighbors. Then the neighbors would dig out the ground between them and throw it to the front, thus forming a continuing line of earthen parapets. But if their antagonists were firing or danger was near, it was preferable to deepen the trenches and throw up larger earth protection before joining the individual trenches. In the rear of such hasty works, heavier lines often were constructed by large forces working with spades. One soldier wrote, "As soon as we halted and formed our line, we began to build our breastworks. This had now become almost second nature, and the men needed no urging to do this. It was one duty that no one shirked. No matter how tired, they would not rest or eat until they had a trench dug that would stop bullets." Another soldier wrote, "We had shovels, and our first work was to dig pits. There were two men to a pit, and while one dug, the other watched with a gun in hand. Every few minutes, they changed places until the pit was large enough to protect them." Some of the officers seemed to, commanding officers seemed to really get into this too. One officer wrote, "Burnside's men are great at throwing dirt. All this army have got to be very expert diggers, being able to do a full day's work with no other tools than a tin plate and their bayonet. But the Ninth Corps far surpasses all others that I have seen, both in the height and number of their breastworks." The same officer wrote, "General Warren is now in his element. So far as I can learn, he is his own officer of the trenches and commander of the working parties. There is nothing that he likes so much as overseeing work, and consequently is in a most agreeable humor." Now, of course, Warren had been an engineer officer before the war, and of course up till Gettysburg he served as an engineer officer, so he was into that anyway. Sometimes there was a lack of tools, and one soldier said, "We had no tools at first, but we had become adept at trenching and could use anything in reach to quickly dig and throw dirt ahead of us. We worked in pairs at each pit, first loosening up the ground with our bayonets and then using anything we could find to push the dirt to the front. Our hands and the dish we had in our haversacks would do this work when we had no picks and shovels. It was really wonderful how fast one could pile up material sufficient to stop bullets when they were singing about him." Yeah, an officer wrote, "During the night, earthworks were thrown up by the division along the whole line. But owing to the scarcity of entrenching tools, many of the men were obliged to use their saber bayonets, tin plates, and in some cases merely their hands to scrape up the dirt for the breastworks." One job that was involved quite a bit, they used wood in building some of the fortifications, plus they wanted to clear out the front, the area in front of the fortifications, so that there wouldn't be anything that the attacking troops could hide behind. So they were forever cutting down trees. One soldier wrote, "To strengthen our works, we cut the timber in our front so as to make an abattis that would delay an attacking force should there be an assault on our line." A soldier in the 79th New York Highlanders wrote, "Such a process of deforestation was the hardest kind of manual labor. Spades were trump, and every man had held a full hand." Now, every once in a while, you get pretty specific specifications of what they're going to build. General William B. Hazen, when he was near Jonesboro, Georgia, in September of 1864, wrote this: "Hereafter, when this command constructs breastworks, the following specifications will be observed: a revetment along the line determined upon, either of logs notched into each other, or of rails placed between strong stakes, or of stone, or sods, or any material that may be convenient, will be placed 2.5 feet high. Then, on the rear side of the works, an excavation will be made 2.5 feet deep, a step being left on the front side 1.5 feet high. No earth to be broken in front of the works. This excavation will be wide enough to furnish all the earth required in front. Head logs will be added if needed. Another officer wrote, "From our officer of the trenches, we learned that our working party opened the trenches heretofore constructed of about 280 yards to an average width of 6 feet, constructed new trenches about 100 yards, 2 feet deep, and about 2.5 feet wide, making the work continuous from the Halls Ferry Road to the right in front of the large rebel works." So, after the men had built these works, they started to relax a little bit. And as one officer said, "A feeling of intense satisfaction pervaded the whole command, and many persons assured me of their conversion to a belief in dirt digging. It certainly proved efficient here." Now, as far as actually doing the construction work, the ideal would, of course, been to have an engineer or engineers to actually not only set it up on the ground, but to actually do the work. But there weren't that many engineers actually in the Army during the Civil War, so you couldn't have that happen that often. And you couldn't have topographical engineers. A lot of people don't realize when the war started, there were actually two corps of engineers. There was the Corps of Engineers and the Corps of Topographical Engineers, who might have picked out the location for the fortifications and drawn maps or plans of them. In the middle of the war, because they didn't have enough on the staffs of the different general officers to have both, they combined the two, so that then you just had one engineer officer who was in charge of both what had been two corps before. And you didn't have an engineer, even commander, like, say, George B. McClellan, whose idea it was to build the fortifications to protect Washington, D.C. So you had to look for other places for people to do the work. One thing, you might sometimes use a pioneer soldiers, or you usually had to go to the men themselves. And as I've just read to you the comments of a lot of these soldiers, they did an awful lot of it during the war. And you would often see them. These are probably hired laborers here, but see them going off to dig and whatever. There were a lot of different drawings that I see, not as many pictures actually as I see drawings of them building fortifications.
Were the drawings done by the people who were there?
Some of them were, and then you had people like Alfred Watt or, you know, various artists and so on that were around. This is one picture I did find, and at least as far as I can tell, it looks like they've been digging, but they're taking a little rest period right now, sitting on top of them. Now, who else might actually do the work? Might be, as I said, hired laborers, like, say, at Cincinnati, when they had to build fortifications quickly in 1862. They basically took the citizens of Cincinnati and said, "Hey, you're all going to have to go out and do some digging." So, they might have slaves. Of course, the Confederates might use slaves, or as the Union, of course, when they came to their lines, they might use contraband. And there is one officer who wrote an order in which he said, "There are undoubtedly in your command a number of idle and vagrant Negroes. These you will collect together and put to work in the fortifications, giving them in payment the ration allowed the contrabands. So basically, as a lot of your fortifications that you would see are basically with the parapet in front and then dug out below, and basically it's about 5 feet, as you probably could tell. And today we can sometimes see what those actually look like on the ground, but there are some pictures of them. There's a fortification there, very basic, that uses a lot of different materials, but some of them you even put artillery in, but basically it's still a basic trench that you had the artillery behind. Same here. Some of you who went to Petersburg with Rick back in the fall may remember this. This is a lunette that we saw. At first I thought it was probably an infantry lunette, but since it's on the water, I'm thinking it probably was an artillery lunette. You probably had two guns in there because to fire at ships that would have been on the water.
Is that a City Point?
Yes, that's a City Point. Now, when you wanted to get to make things a little bit more elaborate, you might actually build a frame. This is the only, I've never found a picture of them actually using it, but this is a nice drawing by a soldier that shows you how they were actually used a frame for the fortifications that they were building. Good image of what it might have looked like in the trench itself. That's a kind of an earthwork design, what you're trying to do when you're actually building a fairly simple trench. Here you see some items that are used supporting the fortification and barriers and obstacles that I will be talking about as we get a little bit further on. This is an interesting drawing that kind of shows you what you might have seen. You have the ditch or the trench on the right, and then what might have been in front of you. And I will talk more about that. This is another drawing. It's not the best copy, but it gives you an idea. On the left, they are building what is known as a fascine. What they would do for the parapet is put that on top and then use that as the frame to throw dirt up over it, and that would help to hold the dirt in place. So that is a fascine, and this is looking at it from one end. There was also other types of fascines that they would use in other places. So that term actually has more than one definition. But they did use fascines a lot of times to help construct the fortifications themselves. Now, there were a variety of different types of materials that they used for the fortifications. Of course, dirt, also wood. Sometimes if they found stone or brick, they might use that. But there were even others. As one officer wrote, the gunboats Hall and Eagle, discovering the enemy repairing the battery opposite them with cotton bales, opened upon it, and the cotton caught on fire and drove the gunners from their posts. Another officer wrote, after a rapid and hard march, I gained the prairie about 6 miles from Duval's Bluff and found the 54th Illinois Infantry strongly posted at Ashley Station Number 1 in a mixed fortification of logs, dirt, and hay. So sometimes you might even use hay. And another officer wrote, on the morning of the 20th instant, I caused a number of hemp bales to be transported to the river heights where movable breastworks were speedily constructed out of them. Now, within these fortifications, I mentioned that term banquet, and I told you that I would talk about it later. Some people know it as firing step. If they're 5 feet high, sometimes it would be hard, and sometimes they're higher than that. You would have a firing step that you would stand on to get up, and then you could fire out, and you might step back to reload so you don't get your head blown off, and then back on the fire step to actually fire. So within fortifications, you would often have a banquet or firing step. Yes?
Might not the hay burn?
Oh, yes, just like the cotton, yes. Also, to help make the fortification stronger, they use what are called gabions, which are like a wicker basket that you put dirt in, and you would use those in the fortifications themselves. One officer wrote, the Pioneer Corps under Captain Patterson were instructed to make gabions and collect them in the camp. So a lot of times you will see people building or making gabions like this. This gives you an idea of how you might have used them in a fortification to help strengthen it. Also, revetments. Usually wooden, but it could have been made out of something else. One officer wrote, considerable progress was made in a battery across the road with three embrasures. This had a log revetment for the interior slope and some 10 or 12 feet of dirt in front. Now, the revetments you see there are actually at Fort Stevens in Washington, D.C. During the 30s, the CCC came in and kind of redid Fort Stevens, and they put wood revetments there, which the local neighbors all came and got and used in their fireplace. So they made new ones out of cement, and they still remain there now. But it gives you an idea of what revetment looks like. Sandbags were often used in the fortifications themselves. Now, to get to some of the obstructions, this is what the French term, it is a French term, and I imagine that it probably would have been pronounced abattis, but I think a lot of the soldiers called it abattis. But what it basically is limbs off trees and whatever, and maybe sharpened, and they spread them out in various places outside the fortification to impede the attacking enemy. It almost worked like, say, barbed wire might today. So sometimes it was very hard to get through. An officer wrote, a detail of 1,000 men is at work this morning preparing the abattis in front of the breastworks near Hatcher's Run. And that's a fairly common quotation that you might find. There's some more abattis in another location. Might also use chevaux de frise. Now, from the title, they supposedly used it to stop horses. And I've never heard for sure whether it actually did stop horses or not. But, as you can imagine, it would be hard for a soldier to get up and over that without sticking himself in his side or whatever. So that was another type of obstruction that you might find out. It depends, but a lot of them would be maybe 4 feet high, something like that. So, or maybe higher.
Probably wouldn't.
Yes. They also used frays. These are not this is kind of a drawing that somebody made, I'm surprised. Usually they were sharpened at the end like this. And you might find them on the scarp, that's called the scarp of the fortification, sticking out, so you can see that it would be rather hard if you were attacking to get up that hill. Or they might put them just outside the ditch like that. Or they might even put them in the ditch. Can you, poor guy that didn't know they were there and jumped in, they might be very surprised. Also, one thing that seems to have been started in the Civil War, this is supposed to be Fort Sanders in Knoxville, Tennessee, where supposedly this was first used. You notice the stumps that are out there. What they did is they stretched telegraph wire from stump to stump. So it also basically was doing the same thing that barbed wire would do, except you don't have the barb, but you would still trip over the wire as you might not even know it was there. And as you were attacking, all of a sudden you trip because you hit that entanglement wire. Another thing that you might find in certain fortifications, especially if they were ones that were around for a while, was a bomb proof. These the men could go into if they were being shelled to protect themselves. Also, you might store ammunition in there so that it wouldn't explode when it got hit. But these are some bomb proofs that were built in some of the fortifications. No, you. No, they'd have separate and have as magazines. No, you didn't want to do that. If it got hit, you'd be. This looks like a gabion, but it's something else that the soldiers might use. It's called a sap roller, and so you would move that towards the enemy, and you would hide behind it, kind of like in World War II, where sometimes the infantry would hide behind the tank as the tank was going forward. Same thing with the sap rollers here. And another type of defense was a mantlet or a mantelet. I've seen it spelled both ways. This is made out of wicker, but it could be made out of a number of different materials. Henry Abbott, who served as an infantry or as an artillery officer during the Civil War, wrote, "To protect our artillery, mantelets were often required. They were furnished by the engineer department, two patterns of combined wood and iron, and one of rope, the whole well tied together. The chief object of the mantelet is to conceal the cannoneers from the enemy's sharpshooters by a screen supposed to be bulletproof." Now, the wicker is not going to be. "When this is done, but few shots are directed at it, and if they occasionally penetrate, the risk must be incurred rather than allow excessive weight." This is a very poor drawing, but it gives you an idea, artillery behind mantelets in that drawing. A whole nother ball game is fortifications for artillery. You can see the artillery there. I mentioned a lunette before. This is a lunette for one gun, and it would help to protect both the gun and the gunners, except the person, when it's a muzzle loader, putting the shell in the front. Then you're, you know, you never know what's going to happen. Now, here are some guns in lunette, but you notice in between there is built up earth. Those are called traverses. So that if someone actually could get to the side and enfilade with the traverse, they would probably only hurt the first gun and the men working on that gun. The traverse would stop shells from going down the line. They would sometimes do these in regular infantry trenches too, would put a traverse in so that no one could fire right down the line of the trench. What yeah, guns sure. Are those? Pardon?
What guns are those? They're very
short. You know, I didn't look. I don't. Does anyone know?
They look like howitzers.
Yeah, that's what they do. They do look like howitzers. Yeah. This is supposed to be at Marie Heights at Fredericksburg, with the artillery at the top of the hill, and you can see there that they've got traverses to keep someone from firing. They really didn't have to worry too much, the Confederates at Marie's Heights. This is an interesting drawing of a gun battery that's mostly made out of wood. But a lot of times they just put the artillery in the trenches themselves. Sometimes they were quite elaborate, as you can see here. And the man who was loading even had steps to go up so he could get up there to put the shell in. These are guns at Fort Donelson. Now, sometimes you didn't have artillery, but you wanted to make the enemy think you did. So they called these Quaker guns. Sometimes they even painted them to make it look even more like an artillery tube, as you can see here. Now, there were some special types of things that they might use, which were head logs that you can see here. They've got the logs coming back over the fortification itself, and then they put tents over the top of them. Or you might see them like that, with sometimes even more. So it basically had two purposes, to keep shells from coming down on top of you, but also, like, put the tents over, and you wouldn't suffer from sunstroke. It's interesting. I worked at the National Archives for about 11 years, and it's interesting how many soldiers applied for pensions and said that they had suffered sunstroke during the Civil War. And as a matter of fact, a friend of mine that I worked at the archives with, I'm from Ohio and so was he. He was from Cincinnati area and I was from the Dayton area. And both our ancestors got a pension based on sunstroke, and even more than that, both of them disappeared from their families for about a year or a year and a half and said it was they were suffering from sunstroke. I don't know what they were doing for that year or year and a half. This is called a Shoup aide. A Union artillery officer by the name of Francis Shoup came up with the idea for this type of fortification. As you can see down there, that there were about 36 of them built on the Chattahoochee line during the Atlanta campaign. And there have actually found, I think it's two of these. I saw one of them myself, and they are going to preserve them. From the beginning, you had people who rode in suggesting this or that for to help with the defenses for the soldiers themselves. This was called a portable breastwork, and it was hand drawn, so it didn't come out real well when I copied it. But it was submitted to Winfield Scott in July of 1861 by a man named Barton Pickering of Dayton, Ohio, my hometown. Also, sometimes you had entrenching bayonets, so at least it was hooked on to your gun and that you could use it. Some of you are probably familiar with Francis Lord, who published the Civil War Collector's Encyclopedia, and he wrote an article in Civil War Times Illustrated in which he included these two entrenching bayonets, but those could be used. Finally, one thing that the fortifications had to think about was vegetation on them. Now, sometimes, and even one of the accounts that I read to you, it said that about sodding the fortifications. But you notice this is being completely denuded of vegetation. What they were afraid of, if they let the vegetation grow too much, that an attacking enemy could kind of use the vegetation as cover so that you wouldn't be able to see it. And after Early's attempt in Washington, D.C. in July of 1864, the commanders of the defenses of Washington issued orders that there would be no vegetation, and the commanding officers of the different forts had to submit a report every month about the vegetation on the fortifications. So it came to be. So those are denuded. But then you'll see other fortifications that had sod on them. And the vegetation helped to keep them from falling apart in rain and snow and whatever. So you did actually have that problem. This is an image from John Keegan's book on the Civil War that came out a few years back. He died recently, by the way, but he had quite a well-known military historian. But this gives you an idea of what the ground would look like. You have your trench, and then in front you have this area. As you can see, it's called glacis. What you would do is clear it of everything, trees, houses, if you possibly could, anything that was there that the enemy could hide behind, so that you had a clear field of fire. Now, they put the abatis out here. A lot of times it might have been here or maybe just in front, but they've put the abatis. So, here, and in some instances, this might be called defense in depth, which was very important in fortification. You had different things you had to go through. You just didn't have one thing that you had to get through. You had a number of them. You got through the abatis, and you think, finally. And then all of a sudden, you're in the glacis getting blown apart. So, demonstrates very much what it might have looked like. Here's a picture that I found that they actually labeled some of the items that in the fortifications themselves. So what I'm going to do is show you some in which they use a variety of these materials. Now, the first three that I show you were actually out at Manassas, and you'll see they used about any kind of material they could get their hands on. The fortifications themselves, beside the actual trench, could take a number of different forms, and these are some of them, the old star fort type of thing or whatever. So it all depended on what you were trying to do, what you wanted to do. Now, you might say the ultimate was this type of fortification, which is Fort Negley at Nashville, Tennessee. It's built out of dirt, wood, stone, and probably some other materials. Now, these type of fortifications, the British at one time labeled them as provisional or improvised fortifications. It's not a permanent fortification, but it's more than just a trench or whatever. So you did have some of these in some of the defenses of the individual cities. But that is Fort Negley. Pardon? Yes, that was made by the Union. Once they took over Nashville, then they built a number of fortifications there to protect the city. As a matter of fact, I was just doing some research for a person who was working an awful lot on Fort Negley, and I was able to find some interesting materials on it in the National Archives. So they built the fortifications, and then they might end up defending them. One soldier said, "Great apprehension of an attack by the enemy on our front is felt, and the troops are constantly drilled in the manner of manning the earthworks. Each company has a space marked off for it in the line of breastworks, and the letter of the company is painted on a board and nailed to the cap log of the rifle pit. When an alarm is sounded, each man seizes his gun and equipments and runs to his place in the works, and then puts on his equipments. It takes the Second Rhode Island just 2 minutes to get into get into line after the alarm is sounded." So they might be defending a fortification, or they might be attacking it, such as this. They might even live in the fortifications, as you can see there. They might live in huts or tents just behind the fortifications. Or they might be eating, sleeping, and even writing letters in the fortifications rather than being outside where they might get shot. Or they might die in the fortifications. Getting shot.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, they could die some of them would die, of course, from diseases. But, I mean, the ones that I was showing there, it was from being shot. In the fortification, yes. This is the Battle of Cold Harbor. Now, what I want to point out is that for the soldier, the fear of being attacked or attacking a fortification was something that I think a lot of them thought a lot about in the war, the fear that they might be killed. And at Cold Harbor, even though I heard somebody try to debunk this a little bit, some of the men were so sure they were going to get killed at Cold Harbor, they actually wrote their names and addresses on a piece of paper and pinned it to the back of their blouse before they went into battle. So basically, if you really stop and think, the fortifications were actually the fabric on which the war was fought. And they had quite an influence on the way the war was fought and how the men actually fought the war itself. Now, in the post-war period, this is an engineer officer by the name of Orlando M. Poe, who was with Sherman a good part of the war. He wrote, "The constant practice of our troops had made them tolerably good judges of what constitutes a good defensive line and lightened the labors of the engineer staff very materially. I was frequently surprised by the admirable location of rifle trenches and the ingenious lines adopted to put themselves under cover." The William T. Sherman himself, in his memoirs, had something to say about fortifications. He said, "But earthworks, and especially field works, will hereafter play an important part in wars because they enable a minor force to hold a superior one in check for a time, and time is a most valuable element in all wars." But then he went on to say, "On the defensive, there is no doubt of the propriety of fortifying, but in the assailing army, the general must watch closely to see that his men do not neglect an opportunity to drop his precautionary defenses and act promptly on the offense at every chance." A lot of people felt that, you know, by using fortifications that you were giving up the offense. So, and Sherman was one of them. So, basically, in the post-Civil War period, the influence of learning about how field works were actually used in the Civil War, it took some time for some to learn, even though in the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 and 78 and the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-05, basically, they came down to like Petersburg. But for a lot of people and a lot of countries, it was not till World War I that they actually understood what they should have learned from the Civil War itself. Now, as far as in the United States, what people thought, especially in the South, it was, and places like Nashville and Chattanooga and whatever, they basically were saying, "What are we going to do with these Union fortifications we got here? We don't want these." And then literally in Chattanooga, they went out and literally just destroyed them and got rid of them. And still, even up into the mid-20th century, there was still that same feeling. Fort Marcy, which was a fort in the defenses of Washington, the state of Virginia, was going to destroy it. And a woman from Alexandria went out and chained herself to a tree in front of the bulldozers. And eventually, today, Fort Marcy is saved and preserved so that you can see it, thanks to her. So, but a lot of the fortifications were destroyed. And a lot of them that were preserved were basically back in the woods by that time or whatever, and vegetation had grown over them. So people didn't even know that they were actually there. But finally, in the 1980s, 90s, early 21st century, there seemed to be a new interest in the fortifications. And as I said, they were found. And even at Yorktown, where they had always said, the National Park Service said, "Oh, those forts you see out there, they're Revolutionary War." Well, in 1862, of course, McClellan had gone down to the peninsula, and he ended up in a siege at Yorktown. And his men had redone those fortifications, and they were actually, most of them, Civil War fortifications. But finally, by about the 1990s, Yorktown said, "Oh, yeah, they're really Civil War fortifications." So but it took them a while to do that. Today, we have seen some very good efforts to try to preserve some of the fortifications, and so that we do see them when we actually go out. Some of them have, over the years, have actually been kind of retooled, but some of them are back in the woods and very hard to see. And I also found out they're very hard to photograph. A lot of times you say, why did I take that picture of all those leaves and everything? But I found the best thing is to take video. Then you can understand what it is. Now, in the preservation of them, rain, snow, freezing, kids on dirt bikes are very damaging to the fortification. But this right here is one of the worst things is the tree pole, because on a lot of these fortifications, these trees have grown up, and in a storm, all of a sudden it's hit, pulled out, and all of a sudden you've got the whole parapet for feet, many feet of the fortification, you know, all of a sudden gone because of a tree pole. The National Park Service has actually written some earth, what they call earthwork manuals, to what type of vegetation to put onto it. When do you cut down a tree? When is it too big to actually have on it or whatever? But there are still some people that are not interested in preservation. Back in the mid-90s, I was out at Port Hudson when we were working on a survey of the fortifications and mapping it by using GPS. And we had a lot of the land is in the park. It's a state park. But some of the fortifications are on private property. And this one man, he had an earthwork going right through his property with nice parapet on it and everything. He didn't want anything to do with it. So what he started doing was charging people to dump their trash in there, and then they would push the parapet over the trash. So he eventually got rid of his trench. But today, in some places, they've done a variety of things to try and preserve it. This is at Fort Randolph in Tennessee. They put a ramp in. You can see the fortifications on the right side. This way, you don't have kids on dirt bikes. You don't have people walking on them to destroy them. There are other places that have done this, like Port Hudson has done it in some places. Fort Ward in the defenses of Washington has done a variety of things to actually preserve that. So there are places, and there's a lot being done to try to keep these fortifications preserved.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.